Now this should start working. Okay. Apparently you can hear me. Can you go to this streaming page? This one. For listening.jovik.ntnu.no. You can hear me and you can see me.
Yeah.
And it's not too loud.
It's good.
In that case, we can start. Now recording here as well. Welcome to the IDS course. Not so many are physically present here, which is disappointing, but the weather is nice. So I suppose that that's the reason why not more people are here, because it would be beneficial. Of course, I know that we have remote students, but remote students must be remote. But those that are enrolled as full-time students on campus, they should be here, especially on the exercises. That would be really positive experience for both sides. Now, small details first about the course. We shall have lectures on Mondays and exercises on Tuesdays. Exercises will be related to the stuff that is taught on Mondays. So, for example, today we have these basic definitions. Tomorrow we shall have exercise about, you will see, basic attacks using tools, etc., and the buffer overflow attack and something like that. So this is pretty hands-on physical work in the lab. That's why it's important to be physically in the class, because then we can have some interaction. Maybe if there are more people, then we make some groups, and then you can talk, collaborate, etc., etc. That's one thing. Another thing, next week I shall be in Trondheim, and there will be no class, unfortunately, because even though we have like 10 students in Trondheim every year, I shall be leading a PhD defense that starts at 10 o'clock and then ends at 4 o'clock. So I shall be busy whole day, so we cannot have a class. On Tuesday, we shall have it. So I'll see what we shall do. Maybe we have a lecture that day. There will be streaming in Omnom, and there will be streaming and recording in Blackboard Collaborate, also recording in Omnom, which means if one of these systems fails, probably the other one will be working. Now, if both fail, that's also possible, it has happened before, then we have recordings from last year, we have enough time to repeat something, etc., etc. So I don't think there will be problems with this. Maybe we shall have harder problems, but we have some workaround. Next, exam. Exam is a 5 hours school exam at this moment. That's the plan. So there will be no project. Several years ago, we introduced a project. So it was like 3 hours exam that counted for 60% of the grade, and a project that counted for 40% of the game of the grade. Now, for some reasons that are outside of our scope, we have to change this. So from now on, it will be just 5 hours written exam until the next opportunity. We shall see what happens, because I have been teaching this for like 18 years, and we had projects for several years, and then we didn't have, and then we had it again. Now we are not having that at the moment. There are several topics in this course. The first one is very short. This is basic concepts. Then we have a relatively bigger field, which is misuse detection. We are going to see today what misuse detection is. Then we have another big area, anomaly detection. And we have testing intrusion detection systems. Then we have abstract IDS models, and we have something about intrusion detection in virtual environment. That will be a guest lecture, external guest lecture. That will happen probably somewhere in October. Well, that's something I wanted to tell you generally about the course. If there will be any more information about this, I'll let you know. You should follow this Blackboard room and these announcements, and also in the INSEA we have a room for this, so you will get messages in two channels in parallel. One is INSEA, another is Blackboard. We also have this Piazza, so if you have some questions you can put them on Piazza as well. So I'm reading all that. You can also send me an email to my email address. So that was very short about what we are going to do this semester. Now we start with topic one, which is IDS, IPS definition and classification. IDS, intrusion detection systems, IPS, intrusion prevention systems. That's how they are called. Where we are going to talk about very general about what IDS is, what IPS is. Then we shall study some basic components of these systems. Then we shall study some classifications of these systems. And finally, we are going to talk about attacks. Now, about attacks, you have heard probably in other subjects, so that will be short. This sound doesn't sound very well, this noise. Okay, we shall see how the recording will look like. So, we start with the basics. What is an intrusion? Well, intrusion can be, as you know, physical. But we are talking about intrusions against computers, on computer systems. So, what's that? It's a set of actions aimed at compromising the security goals, which are usually CIA, confidentiality, integrity, availability of computing or a networking resource. So that's intuitively clear. Now, intrusion detection, of course, is the process of detecting these intrusions, sometimes identifying if possible, and then we can also prevent them, means intrusions or attacks, where we both detect or and identify an intrusion activity, and then we do some responsive actions, usually blocking by means of a firewall. Now, you could, in theory, do all that manually. However, there are too much data. That's the problem, and the data go fast. And because of that, we need some automatic system that would do it instead of humans, and that's an intrusion detection system. So that's a system that automatically performs the process of intrusion detection. Intrusion prevention system actually contains an IDS. So it has an IDS as a component, and it combines an IDS typically with a firewall. So if you have a firewall that is controlled by an IDS, then once an IDS detects some attack, then this IDS activates the firewall and blocks the traffic. That's the basic idea, this intrusion traffic. This all is often implemented in hardware, and we shall see why it is necessary. So you buy an IDS means you buy not only software, you buy also equipment. In addition to a firewall, it can be an antivirus system if we are talking about a special kind of intrusion detection system, so-called host-based intrusion detection system, then we might have this. We might have a vulnerability scanner, et cetera, but basically it's firewall in 99.99% of the cases. A typical IPS is a convergence of a firewall and an IDS. It uses the IDS component that we have mentioned before to detect and identify malicious traffic, if we are talking about traffic, detection of attacks in traffic, which doesn't have to be the case all the time. Then it uses the firewall component to prevent this malicious traffic from entering network, but also from exiting the network, because the attacks tend to spread throughout networks. How does it do it? It enforces traditional static firewall rules and whitelists and blacklists defined by an operator. So you can do that this way. We are going to see the details many times in this course, so this is just very general story. This all is very resource intensive. And why is that? Because we have a lot of traffic at a very short time, and we have to analyze this traffic. It's not just detection of some general detail. Sometimes it has to be very detailed search. So we need search algorithms for that, for high performance. And because of that, as we have mentioned before, we have to implement all this in hardware. So those commercial systems that you use usually have some part implemented in hardware. Because of that, they are very expensive. We are talking about millions of crowns. So if you, we have companies here in Norway that sell these systems, and they are very, very expensive. And it's not just buying equipment. It's consultancy, it's outsourcing of analysis, etc., etc. It's big business. Now, there are two basic assumptions regarding operation of an IDS or IPS. First of all, we have to connect to the system. So we say that system activities are observable. So to detect or and identify intrusions, the IDS or IPS must be connected to the monitored system somehow. It may happen that some content is encrypted. Today's HTTP traffic is 99.99%, for example, HTTPS. So how can we detect intrusions in such traffic? We have to be able to decrypt traffic. That might be tricky. So when we say observable, means that we have to, if encrypted, we have to somehow discover what is inside. And why is this important? Because the indicators of intrusions are, in most cases, not only in the headers that are never encrypted. It's not possible to communicate if you encrypt addresses. So that's not possible. The indicators are in the content of the packets. And because of that, we need to, if it is encrypted, we have to somehow to decrypt it or some parts of it, etc., etc. So we are going to give examples of this. So that was the first assumption regarding operation of an IDS or IPS. The second one is that what is normal and what is intrusive is different. So there is a difference between normal traffic, say, and intrusive traffic. So it sounds very logical. However, the attackers actually try to make their traffic that they produce, that is attack traffic, as similar to normal traffic as possible. Because of that, it's actually difficult to tell between normal and intrusive. That's a big challenge in intrusion detection. The task of an IDS or IPS is to detect these differences, no matter how small they are. So as we said, that's very basic about IDS. So what is an IDS, what is IPS, etc., so what they are doing, what is intrusion. Now, what is inside an IDS? So what are basic components of an IDS? First of all, the heart of an IDS is this detection algorithm. So the detection algorithm actually is where the intrusion detection takes place. Because of that, that's the second requirement. Normal and intrusive activities have distinct evidence. So there must be difference between what is more normal and what is intrusive, and this detection algorithm detects this difference. Now, what is the problem with the detection algorithm? The detection algorithm usually cannot process input data directly. There must be some adjusting in format, for example, very, very basic things. However, it's not only the format adjustment, as we are going to see. So this is done in what is called data preprocessor. So the data, the raw data, must be somehow preprocessed before sending this, what we call activity data, to the detection algorithm. That, based on what we call detection model, we are going to see what it is, decides whether this activity data contains some intrusion or not. If yes, then a detection algorithm that is used here in the IDS, it raises an alarm. So sometimes we call them alerts, sometimes alarms, in the literature about intrusion detection. So I shall do my best to use the word alarm in the future. But if you meet alerts, that's the same. Now, what are we going to do with these alarms? The problem is that there may be many of them. Now, not all of them are of the same importance. For example, a typical example is port scanning. Port scanning is not offensive activity by itself, but it may announce an offensive activity in the future. So it's important to report about port scan, but not as important as the direct attack against some resource. So that's the idea. For this, we need these alert filters that, based on the decision criteria, for example, the decision criteria may be that port scan is of lower importance or lower priority than, for example, distributed denial of service attack, something like that. So that's a typical example. Now, if the priority of the alarm is high, then we first get the report or action in the case of IPS, so blocking such traffic. So that would be an action, a kind of action. Not only that, but that's a typical action. But if we are talking about IDS, it's a report. So this alarm is forwarded to some human operator that sits on in front of the consulate, and then the human operator decides what to do with this. So these are typical components of an IDS or IPS, and the most important one is, of course, the detection algorithm. That's the heart of an intrusion detection system. Now, regarding the first criterion here, how to do intrusion detection, the system activities are observable, means that we have to connect to the system at this point. So this may be in line where we might talk about intrusion prevention, or it may be a copy of the traffic, for example. That's typical for IDS. So, to summarize, a data preprocessor collects and formats the data to be analyzed by the detection algorithm. The detection algorithm, based on the detection model, detects the difference between normal and intrusive. Now, it can be traffic, and typically today, it's traffic. However, in so-called host-based intrusion detection systems that are based, as the name says, on host, it may be analysis of log files, records in log files. Then we have an alert filter that, based on the decision criteria and the detected intrusive activities, estimates the severity, how serious this is, and alerts the operator if needed, if necessary. In the case of IDS, or manages responsive activities, usually blocking such traffic, if we are talking about intrusion prevention systems. In the future, during this course, when we talk about these activities, we usually mean IDS, because IDS is contained in an IPS, so most of the time we are going to talk about IDS. Now, if something is very specific for IPS, like firewall activity, etc., etc., then we shall say that. Now, regarding the data, nowadays we are usually talking about packets if we are talking about network traffic. The headers, they contain, as you know, routing information. So what's the source, what's the origin, the ports, if necessary, etc., etc. The content may also be important for detection of intrusion. Analysis of content is actually resource intensive. Unfortunately, it is more and more important for detecting intrusions, unfortunately for the defensive side, because we have to engage resources for that, which is not very easy. That's sometimes called deep packet inspection. This can be a source of data. Another source of data may be logs. So if we are talking about operating systems, these have logs. And what is a log? It's a chronological set of records of activity, in this case, operating system activity. Not only operating system, it may be application. We are going to see that. There are some problems related to data. First of all, this is easy. Inadequate format for intrusion detection. Why is that? Because the developers of operating systems, for example, they do not think much about intrusion detection. Because of that, the format of the data may be not what is required for intrusion detection. This is easy to handle because you just adjust the format. However, another thing is a problem, and this is that not everything that is relevant for intrusion detection is recorded. For example, if we are talking about logs, not everything is recorded that we need for intrusion detection to be successful. Now, the preprocessor that we have mentioned has to solve these two tasks, to adjust data format, which is relatively easy because it is known what is the required format and it is known what is the input format. So it's just one-to-one mapping in most cases. Now, how to resolve for missing data, which is not so easy, obviously. First of all, we can somehow reconstruct these values that are missing. Sometimes it's possible, and that's the easier case, because the required data is hidden in existing raw data. So that's solvable. However, if not, and it is required for intrusion detection, a piece of data cannot be handled that easily. For that, we need special distances for unequal length data patterns. So we have to compare data patterns that are not of the same length, which is not easy by default. So we have to, for this comparison, and we are going to talk about that, we shall need some special distances. Typical example is so-called eddy distance. You may have heard about that. Now, once pre-processed these data, they are sent to the detection algorithm, these activity data. So these not raw data now, these are processed data. So the format is proper. And the detection algorithm checks this data for presence of anomalous content. Now, we are going to see how this can be done. It can be done in at least two ways that we are going to discuss. But in general, we have a detection problem, which is not small, that there is no sharp limit between what is normal and what is intrusive. Sometimes it's relative. So what is normal for me may not be normal for you, like in ordinary life. So some people consider some things normal and some other people do not. So the same happens in this context. So what is the limit between normal and intrusive? It's not sharp limit. We say sometimes it's fuzzy. No, it's splitted somehow. It often depends on the context. Regarding data processing, something that is normal for an academic network may not be normal for a bank network, for example, and or military network, etc. When we say context, that requires statistical processing of data. So we need some history for this, and then we apply some statistical methods to process these historical data, and then based on that, we decide what is normal. And we are going to see when we talk, for example, about so-called anomaly detection, which we are going to see what it is, that this is a typical way to proceed. For this, we need a lot of memory. So it's not only fast hardware that we need for intrusion detection, it's also storage that we need. And it may be gigabytes of storage. Now, nowadays, memory is cheap, but it's also much more traffic than before. So it's all cat and mouse game. The third basic component is the alert filter, which determines the severity of the detected intrusive activity. Here we also have a decision problem. So it's a similar algorithm. The detection algorithm and the alert filter, they are similar. Detection algorithm can also be considered a filter because it stops some traffic if we are talking about IPS, so that's filtering. Now, how to estimate the severity of threats in real time? We can put some threshold. We can define some thresholds, some decision criteria. But we have to carefully set them because if we set them, if we are talking about thresholds too high, then we have so-called missing the event. Okay? If we set them too low, we have false alarms. So that's the same thing that happens with the detection algorithm as well. So, by maintaining these thresholds, we ensure high level of security by detecting these intrusions and at the same time high level of system performance. So, this system has to work fast. Next thing that we consider is classification. So, how can we classify these systems? Basic classifications, there are two of them. One is by location or by the scope of protection. What is protected? So what is monitored? It may be a host, one machine, in which case we are talking about host-based intrusion detection systems. It may be a network, then we can say that it's a network-based intrusion detection system. It may be a single application, usually a big one, like airport ticket, airline ticket reservation systems. These are big systems or critical infrastructure, etc., etc. So these can have intrusion detection systems assigned. Yes?
When we're talking about application-based ideas, is that hardware or is that just...
It can be both. Okay. The same thing as with host-based and or network-based. So if we are talking about commercial systems, they are usually not only software, it's also hardware plus consultancy plus... That's a big system. And finally, we have something quite different, and that's called in the literature, but that literature is already 25 years old, so it was called target-based intrusion detection systems. The basic idea we are going to discuss. So the name doesn't say anything, but once we expose what is inside, you will have it more clear. Now, that was the classification by the scope of protection or by location. The next one is the classification by the detection model. How are we going to detect intrusions? First of all, we may have known attacks and the indicators of known attacks, previously observed attacks. Then we are talking about signatures and signature-based detection, sometimes called misused detection. This name is really strange, but that's what is used in the literature. So we, by this misuse, we assume signature-based detection. Misuse is misleading because anomaly is also a misuse. So that's something that is very strange. I don't know why they used this misuse detection term. I would prefer signature-based, but you can use whatever. Okay, then we have anomaly detection where we define what is normal. And everything that is not normal, it's an attack. So that's the basic idea. Misuse is we define what is bad, and if we find indicators of this bad in traffic or in logs, then we raise an alarm. So that's a basic idea of signature-based or misuse detection. Anomaly detection, as we said, what is normal? Sounds simple, but it's not that simple. So we are going to see. So, by location first. What is a host-based IDS? The name says it collects data from sources internal to a single machine, a host, usually at the operating system level, where we have various locks. So if you look at this Windows or Linux or whatever, you will see that there are several locks there, and each lock contains records, usually lines of text, where by analysis you can find indicators of intrusion. It can also monitor user activities. For example, what do you do first time you log in into your session? If we are talking about some big system, maybe you open your mail, you read some newspaper, something like that. If you suddenly start to delete operating system files, that will sound strange. It can also monitor execution of system programs. That's typical for virus detection, because if a program is infected, then it will start to behave in a very strange way. So it may try to contact other programs to send information over the net, etc., etc., which would not be expected of something that is not a web browser, for example. So this is a host-based intrusion detection system, not very often used today in practice. In practice, actually, what you have is an antivirus system that contains a host-based intrusion detection system. So if you buy, like, I don't know what antivirus are typical for today's computing, because before that it was a commercial problem. So the manufacturers of operating systems that sold operating system, they wanted to have their own protection, and there were some independent companies that wanted to do this protection, etc., etc. And I think the manufacturers of the operating systems, which we are not going to mention in this class, they won, because now they have their own protection. Now, a network-based IDS collects, as the name says, network packets. Now, when we say network traffic, we usually mean packet traffic based on the TCP/IP protocol stack. However, we know that there are network traffic that is not based on this. In critical infrastructure, for example, they use sometimes some other protocols. In mobile telephony, they use some different protocols, etc., etc. What we talk about, network-based intrusion detection system, doesn't apply only to this network packets based on TCP/IP protocol stack. It is general. It can be applied everywhere. So these methods that we are going to see in this course. However, the applications typically will be on this TCP/IP protocol stack. So this system collects network packets that is usually performed this collection by using network devices that are set to the promiscuous mode. What is a promiscuous mode? If somebody wants to contact your machine, it has your IP address, for example, and the recipient only accepts traffic that has its own IP address. However, if the network interface card is set in this promiscuous mode, then it will receive all the traffic, not only the one that is intended for your host. And that's necessary because you have to analyze all the traffic. So the first thing that an IDS does is setting the interface in this promiscuous mode, because by default it's not in this mode. The not hardware-based systems, intrusion detection systems, they usually use a single normal host as a sensor. It is possible. So that's why we are talking about this, because if you use a commercial system that is based on special hardware, it has special interfaces as well. So in this promiscuous mode, a network device captures all the network traffic, not only that address to the host. Now, that's a lot of traffic. Because of that, usually one sensor is not enough for large networks. Then you have to have more of them, several sensors, and they have to be deployed at strategic locations in network in such a way that no part of the network remains not monitored, so unprotected. What do these sensors do? They inspect network traffic. That's called, as we said, deep packet inspection. They can also monitor user activities on a network. So if some node in a network starts to send some very strange traffic that might be suspicious, then they can alarm about this. So these were host-based and network-based. These two are basic categories in this classification by scope or by location. Now, sometimes application-based IDS are used. That's much like a host-based IDS. So conceptually, it's the same thing, but the log file that they analyze, it's associated with an application, usually, as we said, a big application, complex applications such as a database system, backend system, etc., etc., where we have a lot of data in these log files, so it's not possible to manually analyze these files. Because of that, sometimes we have an IDS that uses application log as a source. So application event logs or some other data collections internal to the application, also network traffic that is associated with an application. Finally, we have this target-based IDS. What's that? That's integrity verification of system files. How do we do that? They actually compute a hash value of these systems files. When I say hash, I mean cryptographic hash functions, because there are other kinds of hash functions. What is a necessary property of a cryptographic hash function? If you change a single bit of input, approximately half of the bits of the output will be changed. And that's very useful if you want to detect that something has changed in the file or in the input. So input to this cryptographic hash function is a file, operating system file, for example, command.com in DOS system or Windows. If this is changed, then it will be detected this way. These systems can also trace calls to other programs from the monitored application. There were some commercial solutions doing this. Now, what is the problem with this target-based? The problem is the update of operating system. Each time you update the system, you have to recompute these hash functions. And this may be time-consuming. But that's possible to do, if necessary. Usually this is used in very specific systems, so not in general hosts that everybody uses. So that was classification by the scope of protection or by location. Another classification is by the detection model. So how do we detect intrusion? As we said, the first possibility is misuse detection, where in advance, before this detection is done, we gather information about indicators of intrusions and we put them in some kind of a database. It doesn't have to be database. It can be a collection of files. We are going to see that in practice. Then, so that was pre-processing, some kind of pre-processing, building this database. Now, we put this system into operation, and then it will detect whether these indicators that are contained in this database can be found in incoming data. If yes, then we have an alarm, and the operator will decide what to do with this. What do we need for misuse detection? We need to understand what is misuse, so what constitutes misuse behavior. For this, we build what we call intrusion patterns or signatures. So that's very similar concept to virus detection. That's how a virus detector on the host works, same way. So the signature here may be a bit different, but that's more or less that. So that's the first thing that we do, build this database of signatures. Then we need a reliable record of user activity. So the system has to monitor the system reliably, which means that it has to be fast enough. Usually it means that. Because if we are talking about network-based misuse detection, then if the network traffic is too fast and the IDS is slow, then it will drop some packets. It will not analyze them, and in these packets that are dropped, there may be indicators of attacks. So this reliable record of user activity usually means enough speed of the system. And then we need a reliable technique for analyzing the activity record. How to achieve this speed? We need search algorithms. And why search algorithms? That are, of course, efficient. Because we have to search in traffic the indicators of these activities. So something that we have to compare with the signatures. So you can imagine, you browse through the whole database for every packet, and the database is large. You have to browse, in the worst case, through all the signatures that you know, and if you don't find any of them in the traffic, then there is no attack. So that's the idea. And here is, on the slide 22, how it looks like. So we have a database of intrusion patterns or signatures. Then we have some pattern matching engine called analysis engine or detector. And we have activities, so that's the output from a preprocessor. If you remember the scheme of what is inside an IDS. And then if this analysis engine finds that some activities match some of the records in this database, then that's the intrusion. So an alarm is raised. So that's basically how it works. An example of a signature, we are given an example of a well-known open source IDS node that we are going to study very, very thoroughly in the coming weeks. It looks like that. What to do? Alert or raise an alarm. What is the protocol? TCP. Now, where does the traffic come from? From the external net, where we define what is external from for our network. Any port to home network, port 139. Okay? If this is in case, then the message to the operator will be sent. NetBIOS SMB CD dot dot. Now, it's not enough that we only have this, that the traffic is coming from external net, any port to home net, port 139. It also has to be a server that is in question, and the traffic is to this server. The connection has to be established. The content in the traffic has to be 5C.:/00000. You see, ignore these vertical lines. I'm going to explain when we talk about snort what it is. So just, they don't exist for humans. They exist for snort. Okay, so it's like this, 5C hexadecimal, and then this is not hexadecimal, it's ASCII, let's say, or Unicode, dot, dot, slash, and then three hexadecimal bytes, 0000000. Now, basically, if we find in traffic this in the packet, for this we need search. So we have to search for 5C dot, dot, slash, 0000000. If the traffic is sent to the server, or the destination is the server that we are running, if the connection with the client has been established previously, if the traffic is coming from external network, not from inside, from any port to our home network, defended or monitored network, port 139, which is NetBIOS, then it's an alarm, because it's this is found in traffic that is directed to the port 139 of some host in our network. And then what we do is raise an alarm. So this is a typical signature. So in the signature, we explain what conditions have to be met in order for an alarm to be raised. Now, when or where and or where we use do we use misuse detection systems? If we know the attacks from before. So that's the necessary condition. Because if we don't know the attack, it has never happened before, then we cannot make a signature. We don't know how what to put in the database. So misuse detection systems can detect known, previously known attacks. What they cannot do is to detect previously unknown or so-called zero-day attacks. Unfortunately, the zero-day attacks are most dangerous, so they do most harm. Even worse, a single bit of difference in misuse patterns is enough for an IDS to miss such an attack. And we are going to see how a system like Snort handles this problem. So they introduce some preprocessors, you are going to see. It is possible to use the existing knowledge, for instance, of consequences of previously known attacks, to recognize not new attacks, but new forms of old attacks. Typically, the new attacks appear this way. So some known attack is modified a bit. And we shall see why it is very difficult to generate a completely new attack. Let's have a break. So each time we have a break, I'm going to get out of this session, stop sharing, stop recording, and then after 10 minutes, I'll be back in Blackboard. I'm telling this to the students that are online. So this is this was the source of trouble. Okay. Now these recordings will appear in Blackboard Collaborate here under recordings. But you see the processing of these recordings take some time and they will appear, and then we check what will be in these recordings, whether, for example, the sound will be all right, etc., etc. And what you will see in these recordings will be the slide and the sound, but not me. And in this Omnom, it will be the camera sees me, but you will also have the slide. So that's why it's important to have this Omnom working. We shall see if it will work. Okay. So 12:10. That's the problem. So, but what can we do? You know, when I switched on the microphone on my machine in Blackboard.
Check the other manual. Someone is.
Which one?
Someone is probably with the microphone on.
You mean this?
No, no, no. Plus 9, just click plus 9. Let's see
how it works. Okay, we shall see. This is annoying, but it's not terrible. No, it was not the contact. Okay.
Maybe switch on a cable or try to maybe like twitch. Sounds like there's some bad connection or something.
Sounds like that.
When you have an aux cable or something, it just.
When you have no earth or something. Okay, next time. So, let's continue with our lecture on classification by the detection model. So, not only misuse detection, but also all other systems, they might get into a situation where they generate alerts even if the activities are in fact normal. So, it has to be checked. Such a case is called a false positive. So there are actually four cases. You may have false positives, which means an alarm from the system where there is no intrusion. In fact, you may have true positive, an alarm when there is an intrusion. That's what we want. Then you might have true negative, no alarm when there is no intrusion. That's also a good thing. And finally, you may have the worst cases where you don't have an alarm when there is an intrusion. So that's called false negative. Now, false negatives are cases that we want to avoid at all costs, but we cannot avoid them completely. We are going to see when we talk about testing intrusion detection and how we set up their parameters, we actually use this as a criterion to reduce the probability of false negatives. Now, false positives are also annoying. So you may get a lot of alarms from a harmless situation. So that distracts the operator, and then the operator will not react when they get true positive. So, why is that? If you remember, an hour ago we said that normal and intrusive activities must have distinct evidence. That's something that is that a system has to detect that they are distinct. And if not, then we get something like this, a false positive. Because normal activities often closely resemble the suspicious ones. And actually that's with purpose, because the attackers do their best to actually make them closely resemble the suspicious activities. So, how to avoid these false positives? We have to carefully adjust the IDS parameters to set the IDS up to reduce the number of false positives, but you will see that you cannot eliminate false positives completely because, unfortunately, and you will see that later in this course, that the true positive rate is closely related to the false positive rate. So you cannot have a small false positive rate and a great true positive rate. That's impossible. So that's one problem with misuse detection, false positives. Another problem is that they cannot detect zero-day attacks. So zero-day attacks, they require new signatures and it cannot be generated before the attack happens. Now, what happens? The increasing number of these attack signatures causes the signature database to grow over time. So we have to check each packet with all the signatures all the time. That's time consuming. Because of that, we must have, as we said, very efficient search algorithms and sometimes implementing in hardware to do that with gigabit traffic. In the worst case, every data unit, which means a packet or a session is several packets, compared to each signature for the IDS to detect intrusions. And this is expensive because the bandwidth is large. It may happen that the bandwidth overwhelms the capabilities of the IDS, and then we have what we call packet drop. Packet drop means that the IDS simply cannot analyze this packet or a set of packets because the packets flow too fast. Then we may have a false negative. It doesn't have that. It doesn't mean that we shall always have false negatives because in these drop packets there might not be an attack. But if it is an attack in a packet that is not analyzed by the IDS, then we have what is called false negatives. That is something very big, very bad, because you pay a million of crowns for some kind of this system, and then you still sustain damage. So if we have an attack traffic exactly in these drop packets, that's called false negative. So that was about misuse detection. Another way of detecting intrusions is, okay, well, let's do the opposite. Let's define what is normal. And everything that is not normal will be reported. So many times in physical world, we do this. So we put some rules. We say what is allowed. For example, the law says that you should not do this or that. And if you do, that will be reported. So you should not steal, for example. So that is something that is anomaly detection. So we have to establish profiles of normal user behavior or network behavior. Then we compare the actual behavior to these profiles. If deviations from the normal are detected, then we raise an alarm. That's how these systems work. The fundamental assumption of anomaly detection is that abnormal behavior indicates intrusion, which is very, very strong assumption, because abnormal behavior may mean that we did not set the profile of normal behavior well. So we did not assume this kind of behavior. Still, it is normal, it's not abnormal. An example of this would be, okay, your professor logs into his session, and each time in the morning he opens mail, reads mail, and then opens, I don't know, NRCO, news, etc., etc., and suddenly one day the professor does something different, so open some file, which is not harmful activity. And then if you don't put that into the profile of normal behavior of your professor, then such a system would raise an alarm, which is stupid. It's not an intrusion. So that's the fundamental assumption is too strong. that abnormal behavior indicates intrusion always. Abnormal behavior may indicate that you did not think about this activity when you defined the profile of normal behavior. So you can imagine how difficult it is to define what is normal for each student at this campus. It's difficult. And that's why these anomaly detection systems, and we are going to say a bit later, they have, in theory, more false positives than misuse detection. That's why they are not very widely used. But they are very interesting. They are much more interesting than misuse detection for studying. How do we make these profiles of normal behavior? We define them as sets of metrics that measure particular aspects of user or network behavior. Each of these metrics is associated with either a threshold. For example, if CPU consumption is more than 90%, that's bad. So that's a threshold. Okay? Or a range of values. The network traffic must be between 10% and 50%. That's a range of values. If it is less than 10, it's probably bad network interface card in normal, if there is any traffic. So we are not considering situations with no traffic. Okay, if it is more than 50%, but this is just an example. It can be anything, any aspect of user or network behavior. So it may be either a single value, which is a threshold, or it can be two values, so the minimum and the maximum. So some parameter must be between this and that. As we said, anomaly detection depends on an assumption that users and networks exhibit predictable, consistent patterns of system usage. Your professor logs in, always reads mail, and then opens nrco.no to read news each time when the professor logs into his session, which is predictable, consistent pattern of system usage. So is that realistic? No, of course not. So it's a very strong assumption. It's almost never true in practice. Because of that, the system has to learn. So it has to adapt to changes in user or network behavior over time, which indicates that when you study anomaly detection, you will probably study machine learning, artificial intelligence. So it sounds very interesting. However, as we are going to see, because of these false positives that overwhelm, that's a big problem, how to use anomaly detection in practice. So, to reduce the number of false positives, you have to model the behavior that is normal very, very thoroughly. It has to be complete definition, which is difficult to achieve in practice, but you can approach to this ideal as much as you want because you add properties. Okay? This makes the system more accurate but less efficient. So the set of metrics that we use should be rich enough to express as much of anomalous behavior as possible, or normal behavior as possible, because we define normality. But that reduces the, as we said, efficiency. Because if you have 10 measurements, it's much more efficient than if you have 10,000 measurements. And very often, to define normality completely, you will need, well, completely means infinitely many measurements, but if you want to be closer to this ideal, you may need 10,000 measurements, not just 10. So that's all disadvantage of these systems. So it's very difficult to define what is normal for everybody. However, they have one advantage that makes them very, very attractive. And this advantage is that they can detect zero-day attack, and simply because of the concept. So the concept is whatever is not normal, it's abnormal. So zero-day attack, even though it has never happened in practice, it will be some deviation from normal. So you will get some kind of alarm. So among these 10,000 false positives, you may get one true positive that you would never get with a misuse detection system. That's why people still study anomaly detection systems and make them better all the time. There are some other advantages over the misuse detection systems. For example, since misuse or signatures of attacks, they are known. So these are known attacks, and many people maintain these databases of, you will see, bug track, etc., etc. You can replicate the database. So if you have some insider information, you can get the information about what is the status of the database of a misuse detection system on the defensive side, defended side, on the monitor side that you want to attack. And then you replicate this database at the attacker, and then you launch traffic against the victim that is not in the database. So this doesn't sound very impractical. It is possible. So if you have inside information, intelligence information, then that's called threat intelligence. So these activities. So if you have some information, you can get the information about what attacks the victim is capable of detecting. And then you launch something different. It's much more difficult to get the insider information about what is normal for the victim. Because take this campus. So each student has its own bubble of normality. To get complete information, you would have to interrogate every student. That's difficult. So definitions of normality are more complex and site-specific than those of attacks. Attacks are very general. Now, bad thing about anomaly detection is the existence of false positives and false negatives, where false positives, that's the typical problem of anomaly detection. Abnormal behavioral patterns do not always indicate intrusions. Sometimes rare traffic sequences represent actually normal behavior. We just didn't think about possibilities of this traffic when we define normality. And that's a major problem in anomaly detection. The false negatives, the other way around. If we set the thresholds too high, we may miss the attack. So we may have an attack that requires 70% of CPU consumption. That's a stupid example. But if we set the threshold to 90, then we are not going to detect such an attack. So we have profiles of normal behavior on the slide 34. That's a schematic of anomaly detection system. Then we have some kind of analysis engine that may also include search. So you can model this as a database of profiles of normal behavior, even though you can imagine how big that database would be. It's usually not stored in the form of a database, unlike misuse detection systems that usually are stored in the form of a database. So this can be some different form of data structure. And then this analysis engine will detect whether this activity that arrives here as input is different from profiles of normal behavior. If yes, then alarm is raised. So you remember misuse detection. The activity should be the same as what is in the database. And here it should be different than what is in the database. Now the question arises, why do we have more false positives in intrusion detection that is anomaly detection than in intrusion detection that is misuse detection? So in general we have more, and because of that we have a lot of problems with application of anomaly detection in practice. Nobody wants to do that because they will get thousands of false positives that are difficult to handle. The problem is in the size of the database. Well, we can say theoretical database. It doesn't have to be really a database. So in misuse detection, the analysis engine alerts if the analyzed activity matches, as we said, an entry in the signature database, which might be physical, but doesn't have to be. In anomaly detection, the analysis engine alerts if the analyzed activity does not match any of the established profiles of normal behavior in some relative database. So you can imagine that it's a database with terabytes of size or something like that, but it is never done this way in practice because it's too big. It would be too big. Now, in both cases, if you assume that this is really a database, you have to search through the whole database for every packet or session. That would consume time. Now, since this database of normality would be huge, you cannot do that. You cannot search through the whole database all the time. So you have to reduce the size of this relative database somehow. And when you reduce the size, then you reduce the precision. If you reduce the precision, you get more false positives. So that's the reason why. So typically, this database of normality is much greater than the database of attacks. Even though attacks can take, the same attack can take many forms. And they, in a misuse detection system, they would all have to be in the database. But still, it would be an order of magnitude smaller than this, at least. So to summarize, there are much more possible profiles of normal behavior than the number of profiles of known attacks. So if we really want to make a database of normal behavior profiles, that would be too large to put it anywhere. Because of that, we need size reduction of such a database, and then we have smaller precision. And that's the cause of false positives. In general, more false positives with anomaly detection than with misuse detection. How can we perform anomaly detection? There are statistical methods. There is big data processing, so how to search for data in large data sets. Artificial intelligence methods, shallow deep learning. Then there were some exotic methods like mathematical abstractions of biological systems. For example, okay, neural networks, they are artificial intelligence. However, there were PhD theses about how to simulate immunological system of a being in a computer system. And then something that is called process homeostasis. I don't know how you are familiar with Greek language, but homeostasis, that would mean tendency of systems to remain in the state in which they are. So if you want to attack a system, you have to push the system out of this stable state. And that's called process homeostasis. Now, what is better, anomaly detection or misuse detection? That's a big question. Now, there are proponents of both. If we abstract the commercial interests, there is really a problem. Because if you want to use misuse detection, for example, so there are activities known to be abnormal, so we have signatures for them. And if you want to use anomaly detection, there are activities that are believed to be normal. But there is a difference between believed and known. Okay? Now, if you believe more, then you will have more overlap. And if you rely more on what you know and know what you believe, then you will have a smaller overlap. Overlap is where you cannot decide. So you can decide wrongly. So you can say that it is an attack even though it is not, or even worse, you say it's not an attack when it is. So the dispute between the proponents of anomaly detection and misuse detection, they dispute about what is the size of this overlap. Now, if you want to sell misuse detection systems, you say, okay, this overlap is huge. Because of that, anomaly detection will generate thousands of false positives, useless information. that will make them not attractive for commercial use. And if you want to sell anomaly detection system, you would say this overlap is not that big, it's small. But we have an advantage of detecting zero-day attacks, which is big. You cannot do this with anomaly detection system. Most systems of today are actually misuse-based. It's relatively easy to design a misuse-based. It's very difficult to design anomaly-based system because you don't know what is normal. Even though the IDS manufacturers do not publish the details of their designs, it's quite probable that they actually combine. Okay, so I would like to detect some zero-day attacks, even though I don't believe much in anomaly detection. So I produce a misuse-based system, and I add some component that is capable of detecting zero-day, well, define normality, and then deviation from normality, that would be a zero-day attack. So that's a typical reasoning of a manufacturer of misuse detection systems, and that's something that they do. Of course, we don't have concrete proofs for every manufacturer, but that's likely, highly likely, as the British say. So up to now, we have been talking about intrusion detection systems. Now the rest of this lecture is dedicated to attacks. Okay, so we say something about how attack traffic is produced. As with the physical attacks, we have phases of an attack against a computer network that are very similar. So we have some planning phase, we have some reconnaissance phase, we have the performance attack phase, and what is done after the attack, that's the post-attack phase. So as we said, this is very similar to a physical attack. So say you want to rob a bank. So first you decide which bank. Then you find some vulnerability of this bank in this reconnaissance phase. Then you rob the bank. And then you do something with the money that you have robbed. Okay? So that's actually that you have stolen. So, of course, this is a joke. Don't rob banks. Now, the same you do with computer systems. So this procedure is in general cyclic. Okay? And why is that? If you carry out an attack successfully, then you would like to exploit this attack by, if possible, penetrating further into the system. So infect other machines and exploit data on them. Or you can perform some other action in your favor. For example, if you get into a bank, I mean not physically, but as a computer attacker, then you may add some zeros to your balance, okay, in your favor. So that's something that the attackers tend to do. Then, which means a successful attack opens the way for another attack. And here on the slide 42, we have the phases. So the planning, the reconnaissance, the attack, and the post-attack. So let's say something about each of these phases. So the planning phase can take many different forms. We usually use the targeted system in a normal way before the attack. For example, I'm always talking about bank, but it doesn't have to be a bank. So, but this is typical because we all use banks, so net banking. So you register as a normal user. So the attacker usually registers as a user, opens an account, or performs other similar form of normal activity. Now, sometimes, of course, if it is not a bank, if it is a Ministry of Defense, you cannot register there. That's not possible. So a military system with a public portal, they might have non-public portal. Even NTNU has something like that. It has INSIA. It's not for external users. It's for the internal users. No? So any of them. So this INSIA has a link, but a Ministry of Defense doesn't have to have a public link. So if you are a member of Ministry of Defense, you probably have that link, but the externals, they don't. So if the service is publicly available, like NTNU or any other university or a bank, the best way to plan an attack is to register. You can collect information from inside in a lawful way. After this initial preparation, we, as an attacker, we decide on the goals of the attack. So typical goals: disable the target. Okay, so that's denial of service. But this is like an elephant in a glass shop. Okay, so that would be the last thing that one would want to do if nothing else is possible. What we would like to do would be ideally data manipulation, add some zeros to your balance, okay? Or unauthorized access to other accounts, if we are talking about, well, every system has accounts, so we would like to do some harm to other users. We could escalate legitimate privileges and get to information that would never have to be provided to the externals. Or if nothing of that is possible, or if it is a special situation like a war or something, then we would like to disable the target. So that's denial of service. Of course, the motivation behind an attack dictates which of the goals are chosen. In cyber warfare, the enemy often wants denial of service. And that happens all the time, as you have witnessed. Now, we have decided what to do with the victim, then we have to find out how to do it. So we have to find vulnerabilities of the target, if any. Okay? Here in this course, of course, we consider only technical means of getting this information. So social engineering is out of question. So because you can take somebody physically and force him or her to give you password, but that's something that we do not consider. So what we do consider is technical means of getting this information during this reconnaissance phase. A typical reconnaissance method that we have already mentioned today is port scanning. Okay? Why port scanning? Because there are services that typically run on certain ports, like 80 port, which is for HTTP or something like that. So we have to detect as an attacker which ports are active on the targeted host. Sometimes, that has happened in the past, some ports on the host may be active and not monitored. So after the installation of the system, some ports are active, but they should not be because we don't use them. Now these ports, the software that handles these ports may have vulnerability. And that's the opening way for attackers. Where does this vulnerability is found? So it can be a bug or erroneous implementation of a protocol, etc., etc., something like that. Or something that is left with intention as an opening way. So this is also possible, but less probable. Now, this can be used as backdoor for attackers, and of course, because of that, if you do not use some port, you should deactivate these ports. And that's something that is typical activity for operators of large systems like this faculty or something like that. So they must do that after the installation of anything. Why is this important? Because the more possibility that the attacker has to study to find vulnerability, the more difficult it is for him or her. So in this reconnaissance phase, actually the attacker wants to narrow down the field of thousands of possible exploits to a small number of vulnerabilities that he can try. Now, of course, today's systems, they are much more sophisticated than the systems like 20 years ago. And because of that, we would like to find a very specific version of the software that the target uses because only that version might contain vulnerability. So the bug that is not patched, something like that. So that's why patching is, well, you know that from other courses. That's why the attacker always wants to know the version of the operating system or any other software that the victim uses. Now, if you announce that you are going to rob the bank, then they will probably wait for you. So you don't do that. And because of that, you make your reconnaissance activities as difficult to notice as possible. Okay? You sneak. Example is port scanning. Port scanning can be done as raw port scanning, like everybody will know that you are scanning ports. This is not illegal. You can do it. But the victim might consider your port scanning as offensive or indicator of some offensive activities in the future. That's why you would like to make your port scanning clandestine. Because if detected, it is the first indicator of the possibility for an attack in the future. And because of that, when we are talking about the defensive side, the potential victim, they would like to detect port scans. And the port scans can be detected by means of an IDS. Now, how to make port scanning not very detectable? First of all, if you scan all the ports all the time, that will be easily detected. Because of that, you do not scan all the ports at once. For example, if the value of the target is high and the foreign secret services, actually, when they plan aggressions, war, etc., they will not scan everything all the time. So they scan one port today and in a month two other ports, etc., irregularly. So they collect this information in a very long time period. So so-called slow port scans, they are very, very difficult to detect. So to detect slow port scans, your time window on the IDS, on the defensive side, must be very, very long. And that's not physically possible in many cases. That's why these slow port scans are unnoticed for most IDS. We have had some master thesis about how to detect slow port scans. It's a big problem. Now, the IDS are also getting better, so in spite of these attackers trying to hide their reconnaissance activities, there are many such activities that can be detected by the IDS. So it's always cat and mouse game. So that's spiral of attack and defense. Development of IDS leads to making them more sensitive and capable of detecting sophisticated scans such as slow port scans. So some of them can be detected, but as we said, it's difficult. Now, what are sources of information for the attacker in this reconnaissance phase? Of course, legitimate public data, so open sources, fora, databases, monitoring tools, etc., so you can, everybody can read that. Now, regarding the vulnerabilities, we have typical sources, which are these, CVE, Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures. Maybe I can open this link. You will see. That is working. So, for example, if you visit this page, you will find something about common vulnerabilities and exposures. So, vulnerabilities in software, they are reported on this page. There are many other pages, but this is a big corporation, this Mitre, so they actually maintain this. And also something like bug track. It was public list, but now it was acquired recently, last year actually, by this company. And they promise to continue this activity, so reporting bugs in software. And there are many others. So of course, there are thousands of sources, but these are typical. You can also use vulnerability scanners to test your own system. So stress test of your own system, like Nmap, we are going to work with this, Ping, HPing, Wireshark. So these three we are going to try tomorrow. there are operating systems and version scanning. Version scanning is done by NMF, for example. Now, we have done all the reconnaissance, then we strike. So the attack phase, where the attacker generates the traffic capable of exploiting the detected vulnerability. So there is, in hacker terminology, we have vulnerabilities, and then an attack is actually called exploit. Exploit of a vulnerability. So that's an attack. So they launch it and hope that the attack will be successful. There are important categories of these attacks. Denial of service, well, the name says, remote exploits, Trojans and backdoor programs, and misuse of legitimate access. So what is denial of service? I know that you have heard about all this in other courses, but we are summarizing things. We are not going to go into very much detail. So any attack that disrupts the function of a system so that other users cannot use it, so legitimate users cannot access these sources, it's possible on anything. So on routers, servers, firewalls, remote access machines, typically on servers, because servers serve. So if they cannot serve the legitimate attempts of access, then the denial of service is successful. It can be specific to a service, for example, an FTP, or it can be related to an entire host, that anything cannot be done with the host. There are resource depletion attacks and malicious packet attacks. Resource depletion, that's typical. Typically, you launch a lot of traffic against the server, and the server only processes your traffic and cannot process anything else. That's resource depletion. So you flood the service with so intense normal traffic that the legitimate users cannot access it. We are going to study this, like SynFlood, that's a typical attack of this kind, on Smurf, etc., etc. This can exhaust resources like bandwidth, memory, CPU on the server. The other category is malicious packet denial of service attack. To produce something like that, there must be vulnerability of the software on the server. And this vulnerability is used by the attackers to produce the attack, the exploit, which is a malicious packet or a series of packets that will cause this service to go down, to crash. The vulnerability is probably result of a bug. For example, missing boundary check for arrays, that's typical. So that's the source of trouble many times. Such an attack can cause even an IDS to crash. So for example, this Nort that we have mentioned today, it's some of its early versions, there was an attack against Snort, against this IDS that actually caused Snort to crash. So this is a kind of request against the server. Now it can be a malicious packet with a payload that causes the target host to crash, because it serves as input into a service or application, and if it's not properly checked, like boundary checks, then we have this problem. Not only crash, it can be taken control over by the attacker through this. This is a hole in the defense of a server, which is used as an backdoor to the target machine. Very often, denial of service attacks use spoofed IP addresses. You will see tomorrow in the exercise how easy it is to spoof an IP address. There are tools for that and no problem at all. Attack may be successful even if the response is misdirected. For example, this Smurf attack is typical. So they want the response to be misdirected. I'm talking about very old attacks like 20, 30 years old attack. So there are now defenses against that, but this is a typical generic example of such an attack. As we said, spoofing is easy. For example, with this tool, we are going to use it tomorrow in the exercise. You will see that it's just a single command. The victim sees that as if it were coming from other machine, not yours. Now, spoofing makes denial of service attacks difficult to defend from because you direct your response to a wrong host. Now, let's see some of these attacks. SIM flood, that's typical. So, you know TCP handshaking mechanism. By the way, in Blackboard, you will find, let's see, I'll show you in learning materials, topic 1, exercises. You will see this, exercise 1 supplement, the TCP IP protocol stack. So if you have forgotten something about TCP IP, read this and many other things, but this is to help you to recall. Okay, so we are not going to talk about this because this is taught on bachelor level or even in the secondary schools. So we don't have time for that. Now, the SIM flood attack, you know how this works. So we have a request. If you want to communicate with some host, you send a packet with this SIM flag set. And then the victim responds with a packet with SIM and acknowledge. Okay? And then normally you would send acknowledge. But you don't do that. You send SIM again. Okay? And then the victim thinks that it is a mistake, so it was not successful, this handshake. So he sends SIN and acknowledge again. And then you send SIN again. And then you do it very fast. And the victim responds all the time with SIN acknowledge, doesn't do anything else. So that's called SIN flood. And there are tools that force traffic to be sent as fast as possible. And you will see that tomorrow in the exercise that they will cause crash of software that handles this traffic. So that's in flood. Now the tool, hping3, this is a command. You see, you have this parameter, minus minus flood. That means send packets as fast as possible. Okay? And then minus S, that sends the SIN flag. So you will get SIN, well, acknowledge and SIN from the victim, and then you would be supposed to send acknowledge, but you don't send that, you send SIN again, and you do it extremely fast. This will block the victim. The Smurf attack is interesting because it uses spoofed address of the victim to send ICMP request packets to an intermediary broadcast address. And then it is a broadcast address, so it will respond by sending the request to everybody in the network. So that's called a multiplication attack. So you launch a single packet, and in return you get a lot of responses that are wrong. They should not happen. So the members of the network will be connected to the intermediary and they will send the ICMP reply packets to the victim. So the victim will get a lot of replies and these replies will strangle the victim. Okay? So the victim is disabled because it's busy receiving replies from all the members of the network. If you have thousands of hosts in the network, that will be a lot of replies. So this is how it works. So this is an attacker. On the slide 64, we have an attacker. Well, let's have a break and then we talk about that afterwards. This really bugs me. Let's see how successful was the first class recording. Sorry. So it's working. Too loud. Okay, so it will be okay.
Exercise that there was something about virtual box there, so you probably
That's what I said to me. Yeah, that's why I'm asking. Because,
yeah. Okay. So probably. You could ask him when he comes back.
Yeah.
To be sure. And I also have to ask him about the mandatory assignments. Are there anything that's mandatory to complete, or is it just.
I don't think so.
Okay. Mandatory assignments in this course?
No.
Nothing. So
no.
Only the exam is basically mandatory, so to say.
The exam is mandatory. Yeah. The problem is that it's very difficult with these recordings. So being so good, it's very difficult to get the student to be present physically in the class. In which case we could do some exercises. But I strongly recommend you to be physically present, especially on the exercises, but also in the class, because we have been having problems with this hardware all the time, so sometimes it just doesn't work. And besides, you can talk to your fellow students if you are physically present in the class. And with the professor directly.
Yeah.
It's much easier than if you have the systems online where you have these chat rooms, but the professor may not read that at that moment. Because the professor may be busy.
Yeah.
Doing other things. Thanks. Okay. So, we are continuing with the smooth attack. So you have the attacker's IP address. So what attacker does is sending an ICMP request with spoofed victim's IP address, which has its broadcasting allowed. So this in most systems are disabled by default. Now this intermediary, since the broadcast is allowed, he or she sends because of that, because they have actually received an ICMP request with spoof address, not the attacker's IP address. It's the victim's IP address. Now, the intermediary thinks that the traffic is from this guy, from the victim. And now, it's a broadcast request. Okay, so he sends traffic to all the hosts with this ICMP request, and all of them think that the traffic is coming from this one, and they all send replies to this one. So tomorrow you will see that in practice, not with many machines, with two machines, but the principle is important. So we show that in practice tomorrow in the exercise. So the essence is that this attacker makes these hosts think that the request, the ICMP request, that came from this victim. And they all send replies. So if you have several machines, they will all send the replies to this one, and because of the number of these replies, the victim gets overwhelmed with traffic. What would be command for this? You see, the same tool, HPing 3, that we are going to use tomorrow in the exercise. You see, the ICMP, that's the protocol. It says spoof. And then you spoof, you don't use your own IP address that you have on your host, but the victim's IP address. You put it here. So this intermediary, he or she will think that the request is coming from this address, and it is broadcast, so it will be sent to all the members of the network to which intermediary belongs, and then they will all send the replies not to this address of the HPing 3 where it is sent from, but to this address because it was spoofed address. So the parameter ICMP defines the type of the packets to be sent. The parameter spoof instructs HPing 3 to send packets with the victim's originating IP address instead of the attacker's IP address. So since we actually multiply the traffic, that's called amplification attack. So it increases intensity of the traffic which is sent to the victim. We send just one packet and he gets 10,000 packets because the network has 10,000 members. So this was denial of service. Now, remote exploits, they take advantage of improperly coded software. Okay? So typically buffer overflow. So that's something that we are going to see tomorrow in the exercise. The goal is to compromise and take control of a vulnerable host or denial of service. They usually do not completely stop the target, and that's not the goal. The goal is to get into the target, to penetrate. The success of such an attack lies in taking advantage of improperly checked input or configuration errors, typically buffer overflow, also Unicode exploits, so-called cookie poisonings, SQL injection is also very often used, etc., etc. So buffer overflow exploits a vulnerability that is called buffer overflow. And why it happens? Because some programming languages, they do not check boundaries of arrays. Okay? So, for example, C or C++, that's a typical example. They do not do that. For example, and C sharp does, or Java does, and so, but they are slower. So these, if you program in C, that's very, very fast. But you have to be careful with the boundaries of arrays. This is typical, so I can show you an example. So you say some variable of 5, okay? And somewhere in the program, you say C of 5 is 1. This is wrong, because if you have dimension, that's 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. It has 5 elements, but you are addressing the 6th element. So that's buffer overflow. Okay? Now, you can play with this. You can make a small program that actually contains some information in this overflow part. So it will rewrite the memory after the boundaries of this. That will enable penetration into the victim system. So what you have to do in the program is to have some kind of try-catch. So this some programming languages have that, or some programming languages just automatically generate at the compile time that it is an error. But C will not do that. Now, the function data, they are located on the stack. And there is always a return instruction at the end of the stack. And for example, with this string copy, we should see exactly that. So you are calling a function that has to return somewhere at the point of where you called it. But you say no. You, as an attacker, you substitute the returning address to some other part. Okay? And at this other part of memory, you put your own program. And your own program will do harm to the victim. And that's the buffer overflow attack. So without array boundary check, the attacker can locate the return address on the stack by trial and error. That has been done in practice. You can find information about this on the internet as much as you like. Then you just simply overwrite this return address. So the program will not return from the function to the point where the function was called. Instead, it will return to some malicious function. And this malicious function can do whatever. So if the vulnerable program is located on a remote host, an attacker can launch malicious code as a client, and that's called remote exploit. So that was buffer overflow. And next example is Unicode exploit. So the attacker misuses this UTF-8 to Unicode conversion in the browsers to send a malicious string to the target. There is a rule how to convert UTF-8 into Unicode. And this is an example. Some text in this string is replaced by hex numbers preceded by the percent sign. So, for example, instead of slash in Unicode, the attacker can use percentage C0, percentage AF. So these are hexadecimal numbers. So these are bytes. Okay? So that's UTF-8 code. Now, this C0AF, that's binary, okay? So obviously 1100, that's C, 00, that's 4 zeros, then A is 1010, and F is all zeros, okay? So that's C0AF, and this is the rule how to convert to Unicode, to slash. So you have 110, and then you have 5 bits, I, J, K, L, M, and then you have 10, and then N, O, P, Q, R, S, Q, R, S. So these are bits of the Unicode. So these are 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. You can easily extract them from this information, and that's 2F, and that's Unicode slash. And that's the conversion that is done inside all the systems, the browsers or whatever. Okay? Now, you can manipulate that, of course. So the attackers actually in this Unicode exploit, they manipulate this conversion. So an attack string similar to this, http www.example.com scripts, and then you have this. This is slash, okay? So it is accepted by the victim, and this is not accepted, because the victim will know that this is terrible, that goes to command.exe, okay? So it executes commands on the victim, okay? But instead of this slash, the attacker puts this, and this is not recognized, okay? So this will be executed. So this will be executed on Windows, all versions, of course, like Windows NT, Windows 2000, something like that. And this will be recognized by Windows, and Windows will say this is not allowed. And both commands do the same. They invoke command exe on the Windows system directory that makes full control over the victim. So Windows would not allow you this, but if you put it like this, this process is called canonicalization. So this conversion of this to that. So that's called Unicode exploit. Then we have something like cookie poisoning. Well, you know what cookie is. And then you modified as an attacker the cookie in order to gain unauthorized information about the victim web user, like bypassing security measures, sending false information to the server, and by this you can do identity theft. So the server will think that the cookie belongs to somebody else. Well, this is not very often, but this is very often the case, SQL injection. So we insert a malicious SQL instruction via a web page interface to a backend database if it is not done properly. So you just append the malicious part of the command to the online SQL query. Of course, if there is input data checked by the interface, that will be prevented. It will not be allowed. But if not, then you get some listing of tables, drop table students, something from the jokes and the comics. But this is theoretically possible. For example, database contains the table users, and each record containing the field user ID, name, and password, okay? Now, you use something like that. Select user ID, name, and password from users database where user ID is any number, and then you add this. Or 1 equal to 1. Okay, so this is true, and this is or. So true or something is true. So you get all the users with their passwords and names. Huh? So not just the one that you can access, but all the others. Of course, this is very easy to mitigate, but this is an example what can be done. Now, something about Trojans and backdoor programs. What is a Trojan? Well, it performs an ordinary useful function for the user, say an editor or something, text processor, but in addition, without user being aware of that, it performs some clandestine action that may disclose valuable information to an attacker, like keylogging. Then he gets a password. And the backdoor program does the same harmful activity, but without useful activity. So that's the difference between a Trojan and a backdoor. So Trojan actually contains a backdoor program, but it masks itself as a useful program. Now, if you install a backdoor program, you usually do that without knowing, because that's something that is hidden somewhere else. Or a Trojan, where you do it on purpose. You want this editor to use, but you don't know that it contains also a backdoor program, so that it's a Trojan. Then with this, an attacker can bypass security controls. Well, do whatever. So, as we said, a Trojan is deployed on the victim system with user consent. So you get some recommendation by email, for example. We offer you a very useful program. You want to do that? Well, we do it all the time. So sometimes if you want to use some program, then they say you have to accept. Okay? And by accepting, that's a legal disclaimer. Okay? So you say okay, and then the sender is not responsible for the consequences. So that's the idea. So you have to be very careful about what you install on your machine. So you install a useful-looking program. You use the program, but at the same time, this program sends unauthorized information to the manufacturer of this program. Now, a backdoor program, of course, it cannot be deployed with user consent. The idea is that you don't know that it is on your machine. You can do it in many different ways. You can get it by adding some malicious code into legitimate code, but that you don't know that it is there, or for legitimate maintenance reason, and then you forget about that. Well, that's exploited by the attackers, because if the manufacturer of an operating system has forgotten that, then it will be sooner or later be discovered, and this will be exploited by the attackers. Typically, that happened with old operating systems. So, for example, retain guest account without requiring password. So that's typical. Now, these remote control trojans, they typically listen on a port like any other application, and through this open port, then an attacker could take control over the host that runs the trojan. And then they can perform any malicious activity. They can disclose, manipulate data, they can scan ports, they can do denial of service and block your system. So you see this, what was called, NotPetya, and all these attacks that encrypt your data, and then you have to pay to get it decrypted, because you have given consent to install something, and then this ransomware, that's how it is called, gets installed on your machine. Now, old programs of this kind, they listened on a fixed, predetermined port, and that's easy to detect, because if you know that such a program exists and that it is detected on your machine, then you block this port and it will not do any harm. But newer trojans are more intelligent. They don't listen on a fixed, predetermined port. They expect a sequence of actions by the user. For example, you log in, open this page, open that page, in this order, and then you activate the trojan. Finally, we have misuse of legitimate access, which attempts to gain unauthorized access to system resources through the use of legitimate accounts. Now, how can you do that? You log in as you, not somebody else, and you would like to get some information you should not get. Well, you have to illegally get some authentication information that you need to access these resources, and we said no social engineering, but only technical means. So just technical means that we consider here. IDS can detect such attempts. So like trying to guess a password. Okay, so after 30 attempts, you get blocked, something like that. No? We shall see that when we talk about concrete systems. So that was some examples of attacks, some details about attacks. Now the post-attack phase, what do you do after the attack as an attacker? Well, in general, it's unpredictable. Well, the attacker carries out his plans and makes use of information resources as he considers appropriate. As we said in the beginning of this talk about attacks, ideally, the attacker wants to penetrate deeper into the network, so exploit more and more. So that would be ideal. So typically, first that you get, that you have to do as an attacker, after a successful attack, is to make it not detected as long as possible. So you cover tracks. Okay? Now, if you penetrate into a bank account and add zero, that will be detected. But if you have 1 million users and add 1 euro cent from 1 million users, it will not be detected. Nobody will detect that. But you get, well, how many euros would that be? 1 million divided by 100? That's 10,000 euros. In single step. Now, penetrating deeper into the network infrastructure, so that's planning next attack. So that's cyclic, you see? Planning of the next attack, and then reconnaissance, and then attack, and then post-attack again. Then you can use the host to attack other networks, also next attack. So penetrating deeper into the infrastructure. Then what you have to, what you can do, gather, manipulate, or destroy data. If you are a really bad guy, you destroy, drop table students. Okay, so that will do really harm. Many people do this for money. So like 20, 30 years ago, that was just fun, for fun. So taking no action at all. So that's now rare. But before that, it was fun. So hackers, they did that just for fun. Now they don't do that for fun. They do that for money. So you sell the vulnerable host to a hacker group or to foreign secret services. Or you know this, how is it called? This hidden internet, what's the name of that? Darknet, that's the name. So Darknet is full of strange things. Okay, so that would be all for today's lecture. Now, tomorrow we are going to demonstrate in practice some of these tools. So it's not much intrusion detection, but you will see how easily you can attack. So we are going to give practical examples of this SIN flood, Smurf, buffer overflow, for example. So that will be, and you will get familiar with the tools. So I strongly recommend you to be physically in the class. Then you get some immediate help if you get stuck. Okay, so that will be all for today. See you tomorrow at 1:15. Story below this. Okay.
Easier than before. Before, the virtual machines, at least the software was not so easily accessible. Now you can. We are going to do everything on VirtualBox. Yep. You're not in this course.
No.
Ah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.